MechCast, Sunday, October 4th, 2020. Hey, Mech Geeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for Mech Geeks by Mech Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast from a still hot studio in Southern California. Man, it is not, winter is not coming here. This is like not like Game of Thrones. I don't know what's going on, but it has been warm. I know other parts of the country and in other parts of the world, you're actually getting to some seasons. You know, fall is here. We're moving toward winter. Things are cooling off a bit. I envy you if that's your situation, but it's okay. We're doing all right here. We can, no AC, but we can jump in the pool if we need to. So that works for cooling off. So hopefully you're staying cool. Hopefully you're having a great week. We do have a lot of, well, I shouldn't say a lot. I was going to say we have a lot of good things to get into in the news this week. We have a few good things to get into in the news this week, but it was a little bit of a light week with regard to Apple news and going-ons and things like that. Of course, we have Apple Watches that are out now, and people are receiving those. So we'll talk about that a little bit in the back half of the show, because I'm going to give you my first impressions of my Apple Watch Series 6, which arrived on October 1st. So have that to talk about. We also have some great feedback, some tips on Apple Watch, or a little troubleshooting that some folks have run into with Watch OS 7. We'll get into that and a possible fix, although the fix is a little bit frightening. We have a tip, I guess, or a fix from a listener for a potential issue with older Macs and speed and performance. We have a listener whose Mac was slowing down, and he discovered an interesting reason for it. And so we'll get into that, talk a little bit more about ways that you can identify and possibly prevent that. And then we have a couple of things of the moment from the community again this week. So a couple products recommended by a member of the MacCast community that are pretty cool. So we'll talk about those, and that will round out this episode of the MacCast. So it should be a good one, but before we get into it, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a show sponsor, and that is CashFly. We absolutely love CashFly around here at the MacCast, because as you likely know, you wouldn't be hearing this podcast without CashFly. They make sure that these episodes get to you as quickly and reliably as possible. They've been doing a great job for us for years, and that's what they want to help you do for your business as well. Because when websites don't load, people lose interest. For every second it takes to load a web page, it costs a company about 16% in engagement, and of course, fewer visits to your site means fewer customers, and that's really not good for anyone. It's bad for the customer experience, it's bad for the business, but CashFly has your back with their new web optimization capabilities. All of your content will be optimized before it's delivered to your visitors without requiring any development effort from you. And with the recent addition of CashFly's flexible edge application platform and implementation services, their capabilities now reach far beyond those of any traditional CDN. CashFly's web content optimization solution includes powerful APIs for solving your content distribution problems, on-the-fly next-generation image optimization, application load balancing, and smart asset delivery. Listen, if your website is tied directly to your revenue, and you know that it is, optimize your site's content now. Guarantee the best user experience for all your customers, no matter where they are or what devices they are using. The good people at CashFly are even going to provide a free optimization consultation for listeners of this podcast. That's right, just for you. Know exactly where your site stands today with a Lighthouse score report, and learn how CashFly's web optimization solution can help add 60 points instantly to your score. Visit mac.cashfly.com. That's mac.cashefly.com, mac.cashfly.com, to get that free Lighthouse score report and learn how CashFly's web optimization solutions can help you. And a big thank you to CashFly for their support of the MacCast. If the rumors are to be believed, we are literally just days away, maybe a little over a week away, as I'm recording this podcast, from Apple's iPhone 12 event. Recent rumors are pointing to an October 13th date for that keynote, and we are expecting Apple, as you likely know by now, to announce four different iPhone models in three different sizes: the 5.4-inch iPhone 12 mini, the 6.1-inch iPhone 12, the 6.1-inch iPhone 12 Pro, and the 6.7-inch iPhone 12 Pro Max. What is new this week is we're hearing that the iPhone mini may be coming in a little bit smaller sizes. Well, I guess typical sizes as you would expect for an entry-level iPhone, but in previous rumors, we had been hearing that all of the models would start at 128 gigabytes. It's looking like the iPhone 12 mini is actually more likely going to start at 64 gigabytes and then also have a 128 and 256 gigabyte option, which when you think about an entry-level iPhone makes sense, especially with how heavily Apple has been promoting and pushing their iCloud storage initiatives. I think 64 gigabytes is probably adequate for a lot of customers. I, over the years, have been slowly migrating my iPhones to larger and larger storage sizes, although I think I've landed at 256 gigabytes. And frankly, I probably, even as a power user, could get away with 128 gigabytes. I'd have to double check my phone, but I'm pretty sure it's not that full, especially now that I use iCloud Photo Library, which the photo library was one of those things that was probably eating up most of my storage. I think the other thing that eats up a lot of folks' storage is music. And if you've moved to Apple Music or Spotify or some other streaming service, you may not need that storage as well anymore either. So it's really going to vary, you know, depending upon the user. Some folks still like to have their stuff stored locally, and I totally get that. You will have, you know, storage size options up to 256 gigabytes. I think that's more than adequate, and I think it'll be okay. But it is just an interesting change from previous reports. All of the other iPhone 12 models, the iPhone 12s and iPhone 12 Pros, are expected to start at 128. So storage sizes being 128 gigabytes, 256 gigabytes, and 512 gigabytes on the top end. We know we're getting somewhat close to an iPhone 12 event because we are getting reports that the main Foxconn factory in China is up and running 24 hours a day to produce iPhone 12s. We've been getting reports that employees are being asked to even cancel upcoming holidays and being offered bonuses for working longer hours. So they are in full tilt, gearing up and getting ready to go. As you know, we're expecting the new A14 processor in all of the new iPhones, so the next generation of Apple silicon. The design itself is expected to change significantly, going somewhat retro back to the iPhone 4 design with a more squared-off metal frame around the edge of the device. The higher-end models are expected to get the camera LiDAR system that we saw, or we do see in the iPad Pros, and all of this year's models are expected to have 5G, although as we've discussed, it may be that only the top-end iPhone 12 Pro Max gets the 5G millimeter wave technology. And then lastly, we are still expecting that Apple will have a staggered release timeline depending upon the model. It's believed that the iPhone 12 mini and the iPhone 12 models will be available in October. I would imagine about a week, shipping a week or so after the event, but the Pro models will be shipping sometime in November. We don't know exactly, and I guess we'll have to wait for Apple's event to find out. We'll see if they actually give us a date or if they just say coming later in November. Either way, I would imagine we can expect pre-orders to be happening on the Friday following the event, as Apple usually does. So that's kind of the latest on the iPhone 12. Again, by next week or so, we should know a whole lot more. We're hearing more this week about Apple's plans for mini LED technology. We've been talking about this a little bit. We know that Apple has been trying to figure out a way to integrate this technology into future products. DigiTimes this week claims that Apple will deliver a 12.9-inch mini LED backlit iPad Pro sometime in early 2021. They also say that a mini LED MacBook will ship in the second half of 2021. They say that each iPad will contain over 10,000 mini LEDs supplied by Epistar, and that Apple is recruiting Osram Opto as an additional supplier for the MacBook LEDs. Now, you may remember that Ming-Chi Kuo has also mentioned that Apple is planning a mini LED 16-inch MacBook Pro, which could see a release this year, according to him, maybe in late 2020, although it's looking less and less likely to me. It seems like we're fast approaching the end of the year, and if Apple's going to get that kind of an update out, they're going to have to make some sort of announcement sometime soon. I think it's more likely that will be delayed into the first part of 2021. And my instincts are being somewhat confirmed by a Taiwanese research firm, TrendForce, who has claimed that suppliers would not start competing for mini LED manufacturing orders for the 16-inch or 14-inch MacBook Pros until the first quarter of 2021. So even my speculation on early 2021 may be a little bit premature if they're not even going to be competing for orders or manufacturing contracts until the first quarter. It could be second quarter, probably, you know, around Worldwide Developer Conference would be a great time to refresh or update the 16-inch MacBook Pro models and also bring out that rumored new 14-inch MacBook Pro. So I imagine that could be the timeline that Apple is on at this point. I'm sure earlier in 2020, maybe they were planning to hit a end-of-the-year release date for a mini LED 16-inch MacBook Pro. But as you know, 2020 has been a strange one, and plans have drastically changed. So we'll just have to wait and see, but that's kind of the latest on what's happening with Apple and mini LEDs. According to Windows Central, Apple and Microsoft may be working together to bring the Apple TV app to the Xbox. Right now, it looks like it is available to a limited number of testers, which is where we're getting this information and leaks from. The app will function just like the Apple TV or app on the Apple TV or the app found in smart TVs currently, but will reportedly work with the Xbox controller as a remote. Not only that, we're also getting additional reports that Apple is working with Sony to bring their TV app to PlayStation consoles as well. The source for this is 9to5Mac, and they say that they are also likely trying to get HomeKit support in the Apple TV app on the PlayStation, although that feature might come later after the release of the app on the console. As far as when the app will be available on the consoles, the Xbox or the PlayStation, details are sparse at this point. All we know is that they're working on it. The other thing that we don't seem to know, and it's not really clear, is if the app will only be available on the new upcoming models of Xbox or PlayStation console, or if it will be available to older consoles as well. So stay tuned on that one. That's kind of all the details we have for now. A few other things related to the Apple TV. YouTube seems to be slowly rolling out 4K video support for the Apple TV, something that was promised in tvOS 14. They seem to be enabling it on the software on the server side. So whether or not you have it available yet is up in the air, but it is rolling out according to reports. And it is rolling out, apparently, with limits. It's only currently supporting up to 30 frames per second on 4K, so that's a little bit disappointing. And we're also hearing that it's not currently supporting HDR, at least for now. Other bit of good news on the YouTube front, though. Last week, we talked about the fact that YouTube seemed to remove picture-in-picture support from Safari in iOS. That does seem to be back now, so who knows if that was a glitch or intentional. It seemed intentional at the time, although it has been resolved. Maybe Apple and Google did a little bit of talking and worked things out. Another thing that we're hearing is that Apple is putting big money, quote unquote, into Apple Arcade and may be looking to have console level titles on a future version of the set-top box. This is coming from Apple leaker Fudge on Twitter, and he has been reliable in the past. So he says that Apple wants titles that will rival titles like Breath of the Wild, the Zelda title, which I believe was released on the Switch, the most recent title on the Switch. I'm not, as you probably know, a huge gaming person, so hopefully I got that one right. He also does indicate that Apple is working on at least two new Apple TV updates, hardware that would basically support these technologies, a new A12X or Z Apple TV model, which should be out sometime soon. We've been kind of hearing Apple was in development on that. And then for the future, an A14X-like Apple TV model. He says that some games would require at least an A13 Bionic, so that console level experience may be reserved for when and if Apple actually releases an A14 based Apple TV 4K, I would imagine, maybe even an 8K at some point. He also mentions that a new controller is in development, although it's unclear if he means a new version of the Siri remote that many people dislike. I don't mind it so much these days, but it has never been very popular. So I think a lot of folks would hope that Apple would redesign and re-release a new remote with the future Apple TV. But it could also be that Apple is working on an actual game controller, especially if they're planning on heavily pushing Apple Arcade and trying to bring console-level titles to the product. Few other things in Apple TV Plus news. Billie Eilish is going to have a new documentary premiere in theaters and on the Apple TV Plus in February 2021. The documentary is titled Billie Eilish, The World's a Little Blurry. Apple has also apparently signed up to bring a new musical comedy series to Apple TV Plus from SNL's creator Lorne Michaels and his Broadway video production company. The unnamed series will also feature a few members of SNL's casts, past and present. Cecily Strong, Keegan-Michael Key, Fred Armisen, and Kristen Chenoweth, along with Alan Cumming, Aaron Tevitt, Dove Cameron, Ariana DeBose, Jamie Camel, Jane Krakowski, and Anne Harada. So a very big cast, and hopefully I didn't mutilate anybody's name there. In the series, a couple on a backpacking trip through Europe stumbles upon the magical town of Schmrigadoon, where everyone acts as if they're in a studio musical from the 1940s. And I don't know much about musicals either, but I do know there's a musical called Brigadoon. So I have a feeling Schmigadoon is somewhat of a nod to that specific musical. But with that, that's kind of the latest with Apple TV and Apple TV Plus news. Some good news this week for those of you in the UK and Ireland. If you like using Apple Maps, Apple has rolled out its enhanced mapping data to the United Kingdom and Ireland. The data offers more details in building shapes, parks and greenery, and better navigation, along with a bunch more data that comes from Apple's own mapping efforts and their Ground Truth efforts. Those are the Apple Maps vehicles that have been driving around all over the country, taking images and gathering data. So much improved Apple Maps rolling out over there. I'm a little bit jealous also because Apple's amazing look around feature is also being rolled out in three cities across the UK and Ireland: London, Edinburgh, and Dublin. So if you live in any of those cities, check that stuff out. It is absolutely amazing. Our friends north of me in LA have it. Of course, San Francisco in the Bay Area, I think Los Angeles, a few other cities around the United States. I am waiting with bated breath for it to roll out down here in San Diego. Frankly, I don't know why it's not here yet. Apple can't roll out that feature fast enough. It needs to be everywhere because it is absolutely amazing. And that's Apple's Street View style feature in Apple Maps. And frankly, in my opinion, it blows away at Google's Street View. The resolution, the clarity on the images, granted, Apple's program came later, so better technology as they're driving around. And I know Google's improving theirs as well. So it's not a knock on Google. It's just saying that Apple's technology is really amazing. And I wish they could get it rolled out in more cities more quickly. But great news on the Apple Maps front in UK and Ireland. I'd love to hear from folks out there, because, you know, we often hear how bad Apple Maps are. Is it improved? Are you getting better results? When they rolled it out here in the States, I think we got a fair number of reports that things did get a lot better. I think Apple's been working very, very hard on Apple Maps, and I think it definitely is improving. So let us know what you think, maccast@gmail.com. And then finally, in the news for this week, we have a date for Apple's next quarterly earnings call. The fourth quarter call will take place on October 29th. It's going to be covering the period from June to September. And this year's numbers could look quite a bit different, because usually we will have new iPhones rolled out in September. So we usually get the first sort of results of iPhone sales. As you know, this year with the iPhone launch delayed, it's going to be quite a bit different. So we're not going to have those pre-order numbers. We're not going to have those numbers worked into this report. So that could spell a little bit of bad news for Apple. We'll have to wait and see if things like the Apple Watch Series 6 and the Apple Watch SE can kind of pick up the slack. Maybe also some good numbers on Apple's services. In that category is also the App Store, and sales there have been showing very good signs of growth. Latest data from Sensor Tower shows that spending on in-app purchases, subscriptions, and one-time app purchases rose 31% in the third quarter, netting an estimated $19 billion for Apple. So hopefully some of those other categories can pick things up. But overall, I'm expecting probably pretty mild, tepid numbers, maybe not so much growth, and possibly even a little bit of decline in some areas, specifically the iPhone numbers. But we'll know more on October 29th when Apple has that earnings call. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another show sponsor, and that is Fight Camp. You know, personally, I've had a ton of people tell me what a great full body workout boxing is. And so Fight Camp is the grand slam of at-home workouts, because it combines a full body workout with cardio, strength training, and conditioning. It hits so many muscles in the body, and Fight Camp brings the boxing gym to you with a mix of cardio and conditioning for a full body workout. They provide everything you need: the best freestanding punching bag on the market, great boxing gloves, quick hand wraps, and their unique punch tracking sensors that show you in real time your progress and stats on any iOS device. And you can learn from 6 highly qualified trainers, ranging from a pro MMA fighter and mother of 2 to a kickboxing world champion. And don't worry, if you're new to boxing, their 12-week starter program teaches you the fundamentals while you get a great workout every time. And you can try Fight Camp workouts for free. Just download the Fight Camp app and select the workout of your choice. This is actually a great way to test your trainer. Fight Camp offers flexible financing for as low as 0% APR. And right now, as a limited time offer, you can try Fight Camp for 30 days with their money back guarantee. Just go to joinfightcamp.com/Mac. That's joinfightcamp.com/Mac. And that's right, you can try Fight Camp for 30 days, and if you don't love it, they'll refund your money. Train like a fighter and turn your sweat into results. To try Fight Camp for 30 days, just go to joinfightcamp.com/Mac. That's joinfightcamp.com/Mac. And a big thank you to Fight Camp for their support of the podcast. As I mentioned at the top of the show, my Apple Watch Series 6 upgrade arrived this week on the 1st of October. Took a little while to get here. I was kind of late in the ordering. I wasn't really sure I was going to upgrade. My Series 2 was still functioning fairly well, but starting to feel a little bit long in the tooth. I think I talked about this on a prior episode of the MacCast. It was just feeling a little bit sluggish. And with all the new technologies that they've integrated, the new sensors, including the EKG and now the new blood ox sensor, I figured it was time for an upgrade. I did kind of do a little bit of a downgrade, though, and I think I talked about this on the last episode as well, from the stainless steel model, which I had upgraded to mainly for the glass so that I could get the sapphire glass, because I tend to be a little bit rough on my Apple Watch, banging it into the side of things. And when I had my original Series 0, I had the Ion X glass and it tended to scratch up a little bit. I'm hoping that glass technology has improved through the last few generations, but we'll have to wait and see. I do really like the new color choices that they have in the aluminum, so that was a plus for going back to the aluminum model, and mainly the big plus was the lower entry cost, right? It was quite a significant savings. I want to say about $150 to $200 less by sticking with the aluminum, and I just didn't feel like I really use enough of the features of the Apple Watch to justify, for me personally, the higher premium price. But we're gonna have to wait and see how wear and tear goes. I did get a recommendation on some tempered glass screen protectors from Dave Hamilton over at the Mac Observer, and I've been looking into those. They kind of seem to have mixed reviews, so I want to throw that out to the community. If you're using an Apple Watch with a screen protector, tempered glass, or even a film protector, what do you think? I've heard that it can really cut down sensitivity, that sometimes the tempered glass ones, depending upon how they're shaped, can pop on or off. They can crack and maybe look worse, and you have to kind of replace them a lot. The adhesive is a little bit tricky. The overall experience to me just sounded negative, so I've not pulled the trigger on buying any screen protectors for my Apple Watch, just simply because it doesn't sound like it's an ideal experience, and I really am enjoying the experience of the Apple Watch. So let's get into that a little bit too. Just my first thoughts and impressions. I've only had it for a couple days, so I can't really give you an extensive review. Of course, I'll be sharing my thoughts and opinions on future episodes of the MacCast as I use it more and figure out what I'm going to be doing with it, what kinds of functions I'm enjoying and what I'm really using. But very first thing I noticed was the packaging when it came. Definitely different than packaging in previous years. Didn't have that hard outer box, that thick sort of chipboard box that Apple typically delivers their products in, and I think this is part of their whole environmental effort. So it was very minimalistic, although I have to say there was quite a bit of waste with the box for the watch face, because the way it came, and this makes sense with how they're selling it with the combinations of different band choices and different watch face choices, is there was a box for the watch face and then a separate box which just looked like the standard retail packaging for the band. So I think they're just marrying the two together at the factory, and then they can sort of cover every combination and they don't have to kind of have pre-packaged boxes and designs. I don't know how long they've been doing this for. Like I said, my last upgrade was the Series 2, so maybe this has been happening in recent years, but I haven't received an Apple Watch in a while. So basically, it was the two boxes stacked together, and it was in this really cool outer wrapper that was a thinner sort of paper shell, and it had a really cool mechanism on the bottom where it was almost like origami. It would fold together and wrap around the outer casing and form that outer sheath, and then it was real easy to open and pull that apart. But like I said, that means that the watch for the Apple, you know, the watch face, which is tiny, a tiny little square thing, ends up being this really long box to match the length of the Apple Watch. Of course, you've got the accessory in there, which is just the charging puck. You don't have a charging brick, as we knew Apple was taking those out this year. So it just seemed like a lot of excess packaging, especially for a company who is sort of focused on their environmental efforts. But overall, great unboxing experience, just like you would expect always from Apple. Setup was a breeze as far as what I had to do, just unpair my old Apple Watch, which creates a backup, and then go through the repairing process, restore from backup with the new watch. I was up and running fairly quickly. Didn't take too long. Probably the whole process, maybe 30 to 45 minutes to get back up and running. The other thing I noticed immediately once I put the Apple Watch on was the thinner profile. I can't remember which version, which iteration it got a little bit thinner. It might have been with the Series 3. I don't think it's changed too much in terms of the thickness, but definitely from my Series 2, it feels a little bit lower profile on my wrist. I do love, like I said, the new aluminum colors. I just went with the Space Gray. Was really tempted by the Midnight Blue, which I think looks gorgeous, and of course the Product Red. I just felt like with black, Space Gray band choices get a little bit broader if I do want to swap out or get a band later. As far as the brand, the band that I went with getting the new Apple Watch, I went with the Sport Band, not the Loop. Was a little bit worried about sizing and stuff like on that. I think if I ever get one of those, I probably want to have it purchase one when I can go into the store and actually try it out. I went with the yellow band. I think Apple calls it Ginger. So I'm calling it kind of my bumblebee version of the Apple Watch. And I really like it because it does match my iPhone case. So I got the yellow leather iPhone case. So that all looks together. I'm color coordinated, although I've never been much of a fashion person, so it doesn't really matter. But fan of the color yellow. So it brightens my day, makes me feel happy. And I was super excited to get my new Apple Watch. As far as you know, the experience upgrading from the Series 2, as you likely could have guessed, the number one thing I'm enjoying about the new Apple Watch is the speed. I immediately noticed how much faster it was at launching apps and just in general usage, like accessing information on it actually works now. It's snappy. It's quick. I can actually use apps. I honestly, with my Series 2, I never used any apps. I just basically used the basic functions of the watch because it took, you know, 30, 40, 60 seconds to launch an app, and it was really annoying and frustrating. I did not get the GPS model. I stuck with the Wi-Fi, mainly because I always have my iPhone with me, and I didn't like the thought of having to buy another service or pay additional money monthly to get that access. I just frankly am not out and about without my iPhone in any situation. I am trying to exercise a little bit more, get a little bit healthier, so this is going to help me do that. And while that would be convenient to not always have to take my Apple Watch, again, trying to save cost, save a little bit of money, for me, I just couldn't justify it for kind of my use case. The other thing that immediately makes the watch feel speedier and quicker, of course, is the always-on face. Just looking down, glancing to get information to the watch happens quicker, right? The display just gets a little bit brighter, things zoom up, and it's nice, quick, and snappy. So I am loving that. That's probably the biggest thing about this upgrade that is going to make using the Apple Watch feel better for me, feel more integrated. It's sort of how my impression of it has been in the last couple of days I've been using it. It's much more seamless moving between my iPhone and the Apple Watch. I can rely on the Apple Watch a lot more for notifications and information because I can tap through and get additional things. In the past, it was kind of like it was great for the notification, but I wouldn't click through. So say I got a new email message coming in from Spark. I would not click through on my Apple Watch because it would take forever for the message to load. I'd just go, okay, I've got a new message. I want to check that. I'd pick up my iPhone at that point and look. Now I can actually look at the Apple Watch, find out if it's something that I need to address immediately or get into, and then I can move over to my phone. So that's been a huge game changer for me. The other feature I started using is the new sleep tracking feature. It's only been a couple nights, but that seems to work very well. At the end of the day, I have plenty of battery life. I want to say I'm about typically at 50%, so I just sleep through the night. It doesn't seem to drain very much while in sleep mode or night mode. And then in the morning, just pop it on the charger while I'm getting ready, and it'll charge back up pretty quickly, within, you know, 10, 15 minutes to 80, 90% of battery. And that's more than enough to get me through the day. So that's going to be easy to use. I also, you know, tried the oxygen, blood oxygen sensor, and of course the new ECG, or new to me, ECG technology. And that's great as well. It's nice to be able to get those numbers. I don't know how, you know, that's going to change my usage of Apple Watch daily, but they are nice features to have, and they're kind of fun to play around with. But I really think apps are going to be the big game changer for me. I like to use Fantastical for my calendar. I use Spark for my email, and I use carrot for my weather. So to be able to have all those is really great. I haven't had a chance or an opportunity to go in and play with new Apple Watch faces too much. Modular is still my face of choice, although there is a modular Pro version that I now have access to. So I think the other things that are I'm kind of enjoying are the Watch OS 7 features. And I guess that's another thing to bring up in terms of why I upgraded. My Series 2 wasn't going to be able to upgrade to the latest version of Watch OS. So that's kind of a two-tier one. One, to be able to talk about it firsthand here on the MacCast, but more importantly, just to be able to use the latest and greatest features of Apple Watch. One that I am finding I'm surprisingly liking a little bit more than I thought I would was the hand washing detection. This is the feature that when you start washing your hands, it reminds you or starts a timer automatically to give you 20 seconds to make sure that you're doing an adequate job washing your hands. And it is kind of pointing out to me that I was maybe a little too quick in the past. And also, I had a little conversation with a MacCast listener who was having trouble triggering it reliably, and we discovered something, or we think we discovered something, that it seems like what it does is it uses the microphones to detect running water to kind of trigger the timer to start. So it's not just the hand motions. It seems to be hand motions and noise from the running water on the faucet. So you do need to make sure you have the faucet running and your hands kind of directly under it so that it can detect that noise, and then it will start the timer. I also noticed that it will kind of retroactively start the timer. So it gives you 20 seconds, but if it's a little bit delayed and it detects you had already started washing your hands, it seems to notice that and start the timer at the right interval. So it goes running for 20 seconds and then you can, you know, finish up. And you don't have to have the water on the whole time. It just needs to have that right at the beginning to detect it. So if you're environmentally conscious like that, you can shut off the water, finish soaping up your hands, and then turn it back on to do your rinse. And it works really pretty good. And I'm totally surprised because I thought that was going to be just a gimmicky feature that I might not use. But I actually am liking it. I wish the animation was a little less silly, but hey, you can't have everything. Overall, for me, I think this is a very worthwhile upgrade. I think probably for anyone coming from a Series 3 or earlier, or if you have a later model watch and you just want some of the new features, specifically the blood oxygen sensor, then it could be a good upgrade for you. Like I said, it's kind of hard to justify, at least for myself, spending as much as an Apple Watch costs at any kind of regular interval other than maybe every 4 to 5 years, something like that. I don't see myself upgrading to a Series 7 or a Series 8 or anything like that. I think this one's going to be my Apple Watch for quite a while, just like my Series 2 worked for me quite well. So I'll probably time my upgrades to when the Apple Watch gets obsoleted by the operating system and then upgrade at that point. But yeah, it's been a great upgrade. I am happy to have it. I feel lucky to have it. And I'd love to hear your stories about Apple Watch, whether you decided to keep yours and maybe the reasons behind that. And if you did decide to upgrade, what are you enjoying about Apple Watch Series 6? And if you have any tips or tricks with Apple Watch or with Watch OS 7 or new Apple Watches that you want to share with us, please send those along as well. So as always, you can send me emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. Unfortunately, I had received some emails from a couple of members of our community, and it sounds like the Watch OS 7 upgrade is not going smoothly for everyone, at least when it comes to some of the fitness data. And this is a little bit frightening because I received reports from a few members in our community that after upgrading to Watch OS 7, they were missing GPS cellular data, the tracking data, the route data for a number of their workouts, or all of their workouts, actually. And when you would open up the fitness app, basically where the map was, all you would get was the starting position and none of the other tracking data. So that's pretty frightening, right? Especially if you've been keeping that data for, you know, likely years, it's all suddenly gone. There were also a few other issues that were being reported. Activity or heart rate or other health-related apps failing to launch or load on your Apple Watch. The fitness or health app failing to launch or load on your iPhone. The health app or fitness app reporting incorrect amount of storage on your iPhone. Activity app reporting inaccurate amount of data or storage on your Apple Watch. The environmental sound level data or the headphone audio level data on your Apple Watch being missing in the health app or the iPhone. Or some people were even reporting increased battery drain on the iPhone or Apple Watch. All of these symptoms can happen after an upgrade. Now, the GPS data missing is kind of the most recent with watchOS, but I'm bringing all this up because Apple actually has a support article on how you can potentially fix this. And as I mentioned earlier, the fix can be a little bit scary, a little bit frightening for folks, but I think it's generally okay because basically this is the process I just went through to upgrade my Apple Watch. And so what Apple says is you basically need to reset your Apple Watch, you need to reset your iPhone, erasing all the data and then restoring from the backup. So they recommend that you unpair your Apple Watch. This will force a backup of the watch data onto the iPhone and then also back up your iPhone and your Apple Watch through iTunes or iCloud. Make sure you have all that data backed up. And then they recommend erasing both devices, the iPhone and the Apple Watch, and then restoring your data from your backup. So basically erase everything and then put everything back on the devices. And they actually have an updated support article that I'll link to in the show notes at mattcast.com that will walk you through this procedure. So if you are considering this, please read that through thoroughly because you don't want to lose any of your data. That's kind of the scary part to me. Anytime you're completely erasing your data from your device, you want to make sure that you absolutely have good backups. But Apple says that, you know, often will resolve the issue for people. Now, if you don't want to do that, I can tell you that there has been some indication from Reddit reports and things that I've heard from members of our community that Apple is totally aware of this issue, especially with the GPS tracking data being missing, and that their engineers have been looking into it. And there seems to be some indication that this is a syncing problem with some users on the iCloud side. Like, I was not impacted by this. It seems to be limited to a smaller number of users. I don't know how widespread it is. Like I said, I've received a couple reports from people in the MacCast community, so it's definitely out there. It's definitely something that is happening. Not clear how widespread it is, but there's some indication from Apple's engineering team that it could be on their side, and they are working on a fix that would hopefully be coming in a future watchOS, iOS software update. But if you don't want to wait for that, you could try the reset procedure and see where you get to. If it does work for you, let us know about that and we can share that with other members of the community on a future episode. The only other thing that I can think of is I do think you can get a copy of your data from iCloud before you start this procedure. If you go to your Apple ID account and then click on the Manage Data and Privacy section, and I think you can request a copy of your data. I don't know if you can specifically get your health and fitness data, although because it is encrypted, you might be able to get an encrypted version of it. It's something that's maybe worth looking into. I did request a download before the show of the other data from my iCloud, but I don't think I've received the email back from Apple that download is ready. So it might be a lot of data too, so just be prepared for a potentially big download. But if you have run into this problem, it does sound like there's a possible fix, or at least a fix maybe coming in the future. Received another interesting email this week from Derek, who is the proud owner of an aging, older MacBook Pro that is still functioning very, very well for him, or at least it was going strong until last week. He has a 2011 15-inch MacBook Pro, great model MacBook Pro. I actually had that model for years before I updated to this 2016 or the 2015 model, and then more recently the 2019 model. But hey, Derek, running strong with an almost 10-year-old MacBook Pro, and it was going great when he suddenly noticed a downgrade in performance. It started to run slowly. The laptop, he said, almost functions exclusively as a desktop. So he says, you know, it's always plugged in. I'm never running off battery power. And so his immediate thought was to check the SSD. So he had done an SSD upgrade, which is a great performance boost if you do have an older Mac. Seriously, that does not have an SSD in it, consider that upgrade. It will give your Mac brand new life. I guarantee it. So if you're willing to do that upgrade, it's a worthwhile upgrade. But in Derek's case, he had already done that upgrade. And so often when Macs are running slow, one thing that can slow them down is if you're running out of disk space. And Derek did know he had a very full hard drive. So he went through, he cleared off a bunch of disk space, hoping that that would remedy the problem. It didn't. And then what he did was he went in and he checked the activity monitor and noticed that the kernel task process was using 300% CPU. And I'll tell you right now, this is not that unusual to see, because I think we've talked about this in the past on the MacCast. The operating system has a feature to protect the CPU if the CPU temperature gets too high. Thermal throttling is what it's called. We've talked about it. And what the operating system does to basically throttle the CPU is it starts kicking up this kernel task process. And the kernel task process is not really using 300% of the CPU. What it's doing is it's tricking the other applications into thinking it's using up all of the CPU. And the other applications will think, oh, I have less CPU available to me. And so they'll slow themselves down in terms of processes, and that will help bring the temperature of the processor down, right? Because it's going to stop working so hard, and then it gives it a chance to cool down, protecting your system, protecting the CPU, protecting the components. And that should not happen too often. It can happen under very heavy load for sustained amounts of time. And a lot of people have complained about that. There's tricks and tips to getting around it. A lot of people will install like fan tools that'll allow you to control fan speed or have your fans run all the time. So you can kind of work around it. But basically, the kernel task starts to quote unquote steal CPU cycles from the other apps in an attempt to cool them down. So this was kind of what Derek was seeing on his MacBook Pro, but it wasn't under load. And what was even more interesting was he said he noticed that he didn't really hear the fans running anymore. And after he realized that, he started poking around and he noticed, wait a minute, I don't see my battery icon in the menu bar anymore. Like there was just no battery icon. And so quick check of the system information. So going into the Apple menu about this Mac and then clicking on the system report and looking under the battery tab, he noticed he had no battery at all. There was no recognition of any kind of battery being installed in his MacBook Pro. So what he discovered was that another area or another time when you might see this thermal throttling, this kernel task kicking off, is when you have a very low dying or dead battery. And so he was able to actually resolve this by simply getting a new battery. And just so you know how you can check the health of your battery on your Mac or your MacBook Pro, it's pretty simple. Go into the Apple menu, go into About This Mac, click on the Overview tab, and then click that System Report, and then click on Power in the sidebar, and there you can check the health information for your battery. And what you're going to see is a number of numbers, but kind of the two ones you care about the most are cycle count and condition. So it'll tell you the condition of your battery, whether it's good or bad or, you know, failing, or, and then more importantly, it can give you the cycle count. And so I want to talk a little bit about the cycle count of the battery, because that basically gives you a sense of how much time that battery has left. Batteries have and are designed to have a certain number of cycles before they need to be replaced. And it's a little bit confusing, can be a little bit confusing on how a charge cycle works. So you might think a charge cycle would be, I charge it to 100%, I let the battery run all the way down to zero, and then I charge it back up, and that's a cycle. And technically that is a cycle, but that's not the only way you can get to a cycle. You can actually get to a cycle in multiple steps. So say instead, you charge up the battery to 100%. One day you use 50% and then you charge it back to 100%. That's basically half a cycle. And then if you do the same thing again the next day, drain it down 50% and charge it back 100%, you've just hit one cycle or one charge. So it's the aggregate of every time that you use a certain percentage of the battery and then charge it back up that percentage, it all adds up once you hit 100%, one cycle. So hopefully I explained that. It's, again, a little bit confusing, but the point is every time you're doing a percentage to 100% and reaching aggregately a 100% charge, that's a charge cycle. And the number of cycle, the cycle count on the battery's life varies depending upon the model of Mac that you have. So I will link to a support article in the show notes at maccast.com that has the actual numbers for the various models of Mac. They range from 300 charge cycles for the life of a battery to 1,000, and you might be going, wow, that's a huge difference. Well, most models 2009 or later of MacBooks, and MacBook Pros, which I have a feeling is what most of you have, those are going to have 1,000 charge cycles. So if you have an earlier model, you might have fewer than that, but I don't know how many folks are still running on 2009 or earlier MacBooks or MacBook Pros. If you are, more power to you, but you're probably going to have fewer charge cycles, and my guess is by this point, you probably have already had to replace your battery. But you can go in and look, and so you can see if you're, if you're approaching 700, 800 charge cycles on your 1,000 cycle battery, you're probably getting close to the end of life. And if you're over 1,000 cycles, it's probably time to replace your battery before it completely dies like it did in Derek's case. And so you can still use a battery after it reaches its charge cycle limit, but the battery life will be significantly degraded. And typically, when a battery only holds about 75% of its original charge capacity, it really is time to replace that battery. So, this is kind of some of that system protection stuff that Apple got into trouble with, I think, with the iPhone. It's a similar thing, right? Is they start kind of throttling things down to help protect the system. And, it's at that point, just simply replacing the battery can really make things get improved. And as a matter of fact, macOS 10.15.5 Catalina introduced a new battery health management feature. And this is designed to improve your battery's lifespan by reducing the rate at which it chemically ages. And this feature does this by monitoring your battery's temperature history and charging patterns. And then it will actually reduce the amount of maximum charge to kind of slow down those charge cycles, depending upon how you use your battery. So it kind of monitors what you're doing, your charging patterns, and adapts itself in a smart way to fit more of your charging pattern. So if you're the type of person that, you're always running it all the way down and charging it back up, it's going to adapt to that. If you're more keeping it plugged in all the time, it's going to adapt to that. So it's a good feature to have on, but eventually as your battery ages and reaches that end of life, it is going to start doing some of this throttling stuff to help protect and keep the battery life as long as possible, reducing wear and tear on the battery, slowing its chemical aging process. So the batteries also will just age over time. So in general, with normal usage, I think most laptop batteries are going to last, I would say, 2.5, 3, maybe 4 years. I mean, the fact that Derek, you're just replacing it after almost 10 years is frankly pretty amazing. But Derek did order a battery and installed it himself, ordered a battery from OWC, MacSales.com. We love them here at the MacCast. They are a great company. You can get batteries from them. They have great install videos. You can also use the installation videos at ifixit.com if you want to do it yourself, or just take it to an Apple authorized service provider and they should be able to help you out as well. Probably also an Apple store, although depending upon the age of your Mac, they may send you off to an Apple authorized service provider if it's really old, because certain models Apple just won't work on anymore. So you can get a new battery in there, and Derek reported once he installed that new battery, his 2011 MacBook Pro was back to its former glory, plenty of speed and power for the things that he needs to use it for. So saved him having to do a major MacBook upgrade. saved quite a bit of money too, I would imagine. You know, a battery is probably going to run you $80 to $200, somewhere in that range, depending upon your model and the age of your model. And so that could be a good quick fix. So thank you, Derek, for writing in to share your story. It may not always be something obvious, right, that is slowing down your Mac. We get questions about beach balls and my Mac's getting slow, and often the answer is, yeah, put in an SSD or run some utilities, clean up the hard drive, reinstall the operating system. We try all these things, and who knew, it could also just come down to a failing or a dead battery. So there you have it. That's a great tip from Derek. And then finally for this week, I have a couple of things of the moment from the community for you. Ryan wrote in to say he recently purchased two items for his new 2020 MacBook Pro 13-inch, congratulations on the new computer, Ryan, that he was excited to share with us. And it is a mouse and a USB-C hub or USB-C adapter. Let's kick things off with the mouse. He ended up purchasing the Logitech's MX Anywhere 2S. And again, I'll have links to all of these products in the show notes at maccast.com. But basically, Ryan told me he was looking for a wireless mouse that did not have to use the USB port. And he had previously always kind of just purchased a low-cost mouse, and he was looking for something a little bit more upscale, a little bit more performance, and found out that by going with the Logitech MX Anywhere 2S, he was really enjoying all of the customizable buttons and shortcuts. So this mouse lets you set up different shortcuts, which can be anything from an action to opening a file or folder, opening and visiting a website, triggering specific keyboard commands in various applications, and really allows you to customize the mouse experience with a bunch of macros. So it comes with some software I would imagine you install, lets you set up all that sort of thing. So you can really build out some advanced workflows just off of the buttons on your mouse. And it has seamless connecting and switching between up to three machines. So this could be pretty cool if you, say, have a MacBook Pro with a smart keyboard and you want to kind of have more of a desktop or laptop experience. I would imagine you can seamlessly switch between that and a Mac or a PC. So also if you're in an environment where maybe now with work at home being a big thing, maybe you have a work PC and you have your home Mac, and switching between that with this mouse may come in handy as well. The mouse runs about $80 US, so not the cheapest mouse out there, but it sounds like for the functionality and features, Ryan is recommending it. So you can check that out. Again, links in the show notes at maccast.com. The other product is something that I have been looking for. I'm still in the market and still really haven't found a USB-C dock or a Thunderbolt dock or hub that I am super thrilled or happy with. I have some great ones. I have a nice little travel dock from OWC that works really, really well. I also have one from Monoprice that is okay. It's a USB-C hub. But Ryan says he went with the Anker 8-in-1, 8-in-2 rather, USB-C adapter. It's a USB hub with Thunderbolt 3 USB-C port, a 4K HDMI port, a USB-C and USB-A 3.0 data port, SD and micro SD card reader, and a Lightning audio port, which is something I haven't seen. A lot of times you see a 3.5 millimeter audio port on it. This one actually has a Lightning port. So if you have the Lightning earpods, I almost called them earbuds, the Lightning earpods from Apple, you could plug those right in, any other Lightning headphones for that matter. So I guess if you needed to do a 3.5 millimeter adapter, though, you're going to need that little dongle that Apple provided. Hopefully you have one of those lying around still and can still find it. Those things are easy to lose. But Lightning audio on there, it looks like a nice product. Ryan says he's really enjoying it. It is the kind that connects directly into the side of the MacBook Pro using two of the USB-C Thunderbolt ports. So depending upon how you feel about that, that may be a thing. I'm not super a fan of that style, but for portability, I think it is really good. In my case, I'm really looking for probably a Thunderbolt 3 Dock, and there's been a few out on the market. I guess there's a new one from Corsair that's kind of similar to the Elgato. The only thing there is it seems to have two HDMI ports and no mini display port. So I just haven't found that perfect product that has all of the ports that I want on it. I think the CalDigit one is the closest. The other thing that I can't seem to find with the 2016-inch MacBook Pro is anything that goes above 85 watts for the charging. Now, my MacBook Pro, I think, is a 96-watt charger, so it's pushing that 100-watt threshold of Thunderbolt 3, and I'd really like to see someone do a dock that provides full charging power, and that hasn't seemed to hit the market yet. So may have to hold out. You know, I'm dealing with plugging in a lot of cables when I'm docking and undocking my MacBook Pro. It'd be nice to be able to just have that one cable that I just need to plug in, but nothing seemed to fit the bill. So if you have a good recommendation for a Thunderbolt 3 dock for MacBook Pros, something maybe newer on the market that can do more charging, let me know what you've seen out there. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a moment and thank my show's sponsor, Smile, makers of TextExpander, PDF Pen, also TextExpander, and PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad. You can get more information and details on all of their great applications by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com, and all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM9. You can leave a voicemail there. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And finally, if you want to follow me on social media, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/themaccast, or just check out MacCast on Instagram. That is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.